So I'm Joe Rich. I'm the Chief Executive at Burnet Foundation Aotearoa, formerly New Zealand AIDS Foundation. And I have been involved with the foundation for, I think, coming up 11 years, or maybe just past, around about 11 years. My background, I started in the behaviour change marketing team, working on a program back then that was called Get It On, which eventually became Love Your Condom and Ending HIV. And I did that for, I think, about 4 or 5 years, and was fascinated by behavior change marketing and using marketing skills to, influence behavior for a social good. And then I spent the last 5 years heading up our operations. And then just over 2 months ago, took over as the chief executive.
We'll get on to the chief executive role shortly, but just reflecting back over the time that you've been there, what has been the most successful campaign that you've run, do you think?
I would say back in 2016, when we changed our strategic approach quite significantly back then to embrace what's now known as combination prevention, so condoms plus PrEP plus testing plus U equals U, or undetectable equals untransmissible, and so that was a massive amount of work at a strategic level, changing the direction and then sort of turning that into a communication and some key messaging through the Ending HIV program. I would say that was the most successful thing, most complicated thing that we did, because before then it was very much focused on one key message, which was condom use. But the results speak for themselves, with a pretty clear trend now of decreasing transmission of HIV.
You mentioned that you have just stepped into the role of chief executive, so congratulations. You're coming in at a particularly challenging time with COVID-19 still in the community, but also a time with a lot of whole new opportunities. I'm thinking of the new HIV roadmap. What are the foundation's kind of current top challenges and opportunities?
A key challenge at the moment that's very much emerging is monkeypox. Not something we necessarily saw coming, but something we're dealing with because it's affecting the community we work with so disproportionately. The challenge for us there is understanding what's going on, figuring out how to respond and communicating with our communities, because there's a lot of anxiety out there around it, and of course, so many similarities in terms of stigma. It's right up our alley, so to speak. But it's, unlike HIV, where we've had decades to understand the science behind it and understand the strategies that work. This is really keeping us on our toes. Which is a big challenge. In terms of opportunities, the government's announced a funded HIV action plan that they're currently consulting on, which is a significant opportunity. It comes after many years of advocacy from us and others in the sector and in the community to have a clear direction on the HIV response. So there's a significant opportunity there to ensure our work is feeding into a coordinated approach across the sector to achieve a pretty big goal of HIV elimination of HIV transmission and stigma. And I guess related to that, there's opportunity for us as an organisation to set a clear long-term direction for us and what we want to be doing.
We'll get back more onto the direction a little bit later, but I just want to pick you up on the monkeypox, and you were talking about how it's disproportionately affecting communities that the foundation works with. Why is that? Can you tell me what is going on with monkeypox at the moment?
Yeah, it's a real challenge, because what we're seeing is, globally, 99% of cases are among men, and 95% are among men who have sex with men. And so the challenge there is that when it's sometimes when it's being talked about, particularly in the mainstream sense, it can contribute to stigma because of a whole lot of judgments people place on who's getting it and assumptions around why they're getting it, which is, I suspect the root cause of that is this, the fact that it is generally being transmitted through sex, and as a society, we still place judgment on that and can't seem to talk frankly about sex and things that are transmitted through sex, which is just, you know, should be pretty matter of fact. It's just a virus that's being opportunistic and found a very effective way to spread itself around. But, you know, at the same time, we have to, because it's so disproportionately affecting our community, they have a right. We have a right to know, and we have, in fact, it would be homophobic to talk about monkeypox without talking about the fact that it's disproportionately affecting gay and bisexual men. But in sort of treading that line of stigma, becomes quite a challenge. But, you know, and there's also a lot of discussion around whether or not it meets the technical definition of an STI, which is not particularly helpful. It's kind of neither here nor there whether you want to call it an STI, but the fact is it's vastly being transmitted through intimate close contact between men generally having sex, and you see that in how it's presenting, with the lesions generally being concentrated in the genital area. So it may in fact eventually meet the definition of an STI, I suspect that's what's contributing to the stigma, is the fact that it seems to be emerging and being transmitted through sex. The flip side to that is it can be transmitted through other close contact, but it's seems to be much less the case. So you know you can potentially pass it on to other people in your household if, you know, skin that has the lesions on it has touched clothing or the sofa or something, and somebody else comes into contact with that, and it can be transmitted. So that's a challenge as well, because we don't want to have people assuming that every single person that's being diagnosed with monkeypox is a man who has sex with men. But the case is that in the vast majority, that is in fact the case, yeah.
So why currently is it concentrated in that particular group of people?
Well, it seems to be mostly, there's parallels in HIV there in a way. It's, you know, generally speaking, it's an infection that's not easy to get, unlike COVID, you know. However, once it does appear to be easily transmitted through sex, and the thing with our community, gay and bisexual men, is we're much more closely connected than the general population. There's a lot less of us. You know, we make up maybe 2-3% of the population, and the degrees of, I like to call it, you know, the degrees of separation, that the, I think the movie, the 6 degrees of separation, everyone in the world is connected to everyone else through 6 degrees. But when within the gay community, that's more like 2 degrees. And because we're smaller and we're much more closely connected, everyone kind of knows everyone or knows someone who knows someone. It means when a new infection gets into our community, it spreads around at a much faster pace than it can in the general population. And that's essentially what it is. That's why we're seeing it disproportionately in our community.
So what is the foundation doing as a response to monkeypox in New Zealand?
You would have seen our open letter from a couple of weeks ago. We asked the government and the health system to step up the response. And we are aware we know that they've set up an outbreak response team, and they've invited us to be part of that, which is great. So it is being taken seriously. In terms of what our role is in that, it's going to be primarily around education and health promotion, particularly until we get a vaccine. The vaccine is going to be the solution, but there is a massive shortage globally. The manufacturer doesn't have the ability to make it currently. So the whole world is stretched in terms of getting this vaccine. So we're looking at at least a few months wait until we can get the vaccine. So until that happens, we need to be educating our communities on what symptoms to look out for, knowing when to get tested, how to access that testing. And then once we're aware of local transmission, talking about ways that people can reduce the risk of acquiring or transmitting monkeypox, yeah.
And what's the kind of scale of monkeypox in New Zealand at the moment?
Yeah, there's been 4 reported cases, all from returning travellers from overseas. You know, so far so good, but, you know, the community transmission will come, and it's probably going to come before we have the vaccine. So, you know, we need to be communicating actively about that and what to look out for. You know, we've seen in Australia, you know, they got their first case probably about a month before us, and they're now seeing community transmission, particularly in the state of Victoria. Looking across the ditch, it is starting to grow. They have got some early access to some vaccine, but very restricted. I think they got 20,000 doses, and more aren't coming anytime soon. So similar to us, they'll be looking at other things as well to control it until there is enough vaccine for everyone.
And in terms of the kind of broader community response, have your teams been picking up kind of, what have your teams been picking up in terms of when people are coming into the clinics or getting self-tests? Do they have questions about monkeypox or anxieties or?
Yeah, there is anxiety about monkeypox, and, you know, I think there's anxiety in terms of people worried about being impacted. Should I be reducing my number of sexual partners? You know, what's going on? And in part of that, people not necessarily understanding what the infection is or what the disease is. So lots of questions around that. You know, lots of concern about getting the vaccine, and concern about what people are seeing on some of the, you know, the nasty stigmatizing messages people see on platforms like Facebook under the news stories and things. So a range of concerns that we're hearing from people. And that's, you know, partly what fed into our open letter advocating for a stepped up response, was reflecting that concern that we're hearing from the community. And a lot of the media that we've been doing is trying, you know, to try and break down and address the stigma and educate the general public around why things are happening the way they are.
The other large health issue that's been happening over the last couple of years, of course, is COVID-19, the COVID-19 pandemic. And I'm wondering, how has COVID-19 affected the foundation services that you provide?
Oh, COVID-19. Yeah, what a journey. It's been challenging. You know, I think I'm pretty proud of the fact that we've, although it has felt chaotic at the time, during each of those lockdown periods, managed to pivot quite substantially to provide as much service as we could through remote and online mechanisms. So, you know, we managed to keep all of our test HIV and STI testing going through sending out self-testing kits, you know, moved the majority of our counselling to online provision, and continued being able to send out things like condoms through mail order. And a lot of our, you know, a lot of our behaviour change marketing and social marketing shifted to talking about COVID and how to keep yourself from COVID for our communities. So, yeah, there was a lot of quick changes to adjust through that. I think what's been quite profound for us has been that it seemed to really accelerate the shift from in-person service provision to remote service provision. So even coming out of lockdowns, there is vastly more appetite for things like counselling to be delivered online, you know, which is great. It really increases our reach outside of the cities where we have in-person services, which is Auckland, Wellington and Christchurch, because we were able to learn through COVID, actually how easy it is to provide virtual counselling. We can now provide that at a national scale. And we're also seeing just a continued trend of increased use of our self-testing or home testing services. And that, you know, that might be just because it was the only option available to people during those lockdown periods, they tried testing in a different way and realized actually that's really convenient and have kept it going. So yeah, lots of, I guess I would summarize the COVID-19 journey as a rough time, like for many organizations, just in terms of the amount of work it took to pivot, you know, and just the well-being in general, you know, for our staff and our communities. But also has highlighted opportunities for us to be more accessible.
Yeah, can you just talk a wee bit more about the kind of the online offerings versus the kind of the physical face-to-face offerings and how that balances now?
Yeah, so I would say if you took an example being our testing, before COVID, it was about two thirds in person, one third self testing. So the kits we'd mail out to people's homes, and then through COVID, obviously, during the lockdown periods, it completely flipped because we couldn't see people in person. And then post lockdown, it's almost it's now two thirds home testing and one third in person. Which is, you know, fantastic in terms of being able to reach people in more diverse regions, people who struggle to access a clinic. You know, one of the challenges is not necessarily as comprehensive a service. You don't, you know, to do the STI component, you have to pay a little bit extra if you're doing that remotely, whereas if you're doing it in the centre, it's still free. And of course, you know, in the centre, you do get, you know, a peer health worker who's able to answer any questions you have and generally have a bit of a discussion about sexual health. So it's not as a comprehensive a service, but that said, people still seem to really value the convenience of it more than anything.
Do you find that you get more positive results via self-testing in the home versus somebody coming in into the centre?
We did initially when we started providing self-testing a few years ago. There was a higher rate of positives from that than the in-person. It seems to have leveled out. It's about the same now, and you know, part of me wonders if that's just the almost a bit of a catch-up, like when you provide a service that's now accessible to people who were not able to access services previously, you might be more likely to pick up undiagnosed infections. Whereas once it's been accessible for a few years, it sort of seems to level out.
Have your teams kind of noticed any change in kind of community behaviour? I'm thinking in terms of like virtual hookups, or I know in Wellington there was the closure of the sauna throughout the COVID period. Have there been any changes to how communities are behaving sexually, do you know?
We don't have the data necessarily yet to indicate how COVID in general, the last couple of years, has changed sexual behaviour and health-seeking behaviour. So all we have to go on is anecdote and hunches. You know, certainly during the lockdown periods, we know that there was a lot less sexual activity. And in fact, we had people almost policing one another on Grindr in terms of you know, noticing other people were seeking hookups during a lockdown period. I can recall that from 2020. And to some extent, you know, we've seen a continued decrease in HIV diagnoses in the last couple of years. You know, that trend had started back in 2016. So there's a reasonable level of confidence that there is a downwards trend, but there's the potential that the last couple of years have been impacted by people having less opportunity to have sex, either during a lockdown period, because it's pretty much, you know, not in the rules, or at least with a casual partner, or someone not in the household, or even, you know, potentially after a lockdown period, it takes some people, you know, I'm just speaking for, you know, people I've spoken to and friends, that some people are still very cautious, even, you know, several months after lockdown in terms of whether they're willing to go to a sauna type venue or, you know, so there is the potential it has reduced the number of hookups. It's also potentially reduced access to testing in general. I think we need another year or two of data to understand exactly how much COVID has contributed to things.
We mentioned at the start of the interview that there is a new kind of roadmap for HIV elimination, the transmission of HIV in New Zealand, eliminating that by 2032. And I'm aware that the foundation a few years ago now had a desire to eliminate HIV transmission by 2025. What has been the kind of issue in terms of trying to stop transmission happening? Why is it so hard?
The goal we set in 2016 was to eliminate transmission by 2025. And we set that with some colleagues in the sector in lieu of a government strategy or direction. You know, we sort of realized that wasn't going to come anytime soon and decided to set our own goal. And, you know, to be fair, I think we've, as a sector, as a community and a sector, we've actually come quite a long way since 2016. Infections are definitely tracking down. They're at about half of what they were at that point. And so I feel like we've kind of done all we can do in terms of the advocacy and working together to make changes in terms of access to things like testing, access to tools like PrEP, early access to treatment, promoting the concept of you equals you, and reducing HIV stigma. We really are at the point where we need that leadership and direction from the government and investment, you know, not just in community organisations, but community organisations absolutely, but also, you know, in other important important areas such as research in HIV and comprehensive access to HIV services and sexual health services. So I think we were ambitious, thinking we could do it without the government support by 2025. They've obviously extended the timeframe. We're well and truly supportive of the strategy or the action plan that they've put together. Some of the areas that I think we need to go further that we'd really like to see, I guess, weighted in terms of implementing in the action plan activities around reducing stigma. It's still such a significant issue for the well-being of people living with HIV and for, you know, and it presents as a significant barrier to people who aren't living with HIV in terms of accessing testing and prevention tools. And stigma occurs at a wider societal level. It also occurs within the gay community, and it also occurs in health settings. So it's a really complicated area that needs focus. But also we need more investment in or focus on access to tools like PrEP. We need it delivered in community-based settings. We need people who are non-residents or not eligible for publicly funded healthcare who are, you know, living in New Zealand and at risk of HIV to be able to access this prevention tool in a publicly funded way. We need, you know, better access to more treatments and HIV services. There's certainly lots more to do. And I think the other thing to say is that we're going to have to get a lot more targeted and what I mean by that is, you know, over the last 5 years, we've, you know, been working really hard at engaging our core community, gay and bisexual men, and new tools like PrEP and U equals U. And we're reasonably effective at getting people closely connected to that community and well engaged in health, using and motivated to use those tools. But that's kind of the low-hanging fruit, so to speak. You know, now we need to go wider, and we need to be reaching people who we aren't typically engaging with to make sure that they have access to these tools and are motivated to use them. It's going to require a lot more detailed, focused work across not just the Burnett Foundation, but across the system and across government as well.
And I think you could probably say that through the work of the foundation and setting that 2025 goal, that actually the government has seen that it's actually successful what you've been doing, that the transmission with the HIV positive rates have come down in terms of newly diagnosed. So do you think that this roadmap would have happened if you hadn't been doing the legwork since 2016?
That's a good question. I think alongside all the work we've been doing, we've been advocating since 2016 or even before then that they need to show leadership and have a national strategy that's funded. So I think that ongoing advocacy has absolutely played a part. I think it makes it easy for them to get behind, because it's a very achievable thing. You know, we're kind of halfway there already. The momentum's going, the sector's motivated, community's motivated. They just need to step in and show some direction and invest in the response. We're really stoked that they have.
Another change that's happened just recently, and I've been referring in this interview to the foundation, but the name change, so you've gone from the New Zealand AIDS Foundation to the Burnett Foundation Aotearoa. How's that change been received?
It's been received very well, actually, which is interesting. I think I've observed different organisations or companies rename themselves over the years, and you certainly usually get your tire kickers and your naysayers. But in this case, the vast majority of feedback that that we've heard is, about time, or, this is fantastic. Really makes sense, which I think is a, testament to the thought and the work that went into the process to get it right, because it's not, wasn't a decision taken lightly, building on 37 years of history, incredible history that's very personal to our communities, and some very heroic people involved in the beginning. We didn't want to, we wanted to respect their legacy, but also make sure that the name was fit for purpose for today. So I think we balanced that really well.
And when you say fit for purpose, so explain that to me. Like, how did that name come about?
There was two main challenges we were trying to address. One was that having the word AIDS in the name was, people were telling us it was problematic. Clients would sometimes tell us that, they would walk past the clinic several times before they would even have the courage to walk in the door and get tested. That was a minority of clients, but how many clients didn't even make it into the door to tell us that that was their challenge? Because, AIDS really has nothing to do with the services that we're providing these days. So there was that. It was about reducing a barrier, a real barrier that existed to access and engagement in our services and programs. And the other one was, really recognizing that over our history, our work has evolved. We don't just work on HIV anymore. Our services tend to be around broader HIV and other STIs and even mental health. And so we needed a name that didn't pigeonhole us too much in terms of the types of services and programs that we offer. And we know that, you know, as things have evolved over the last 37 years, they will continue to. Those were the two key reasons. And when we went out to our stakeholders and community to ask for feedback and ask for thoughts on, in terms of changing the name to address these two key issues, the feedback we got, particularly from life members and those involved at the beginning, was, yeah, great, you know, we never expected this was going to be the name forever. But one thing you have to do is honour the legacy of this organisation in the name. And so, faced with that challenge, with that weirdo being laid down, we really couldn't think of a better way to do it than to name it after Bruce Burnett, one of our co-founders, a man living with HIV who'd returned from a Kiwi who'd returned from the US after seeing the devastation that AIDS was having in the US at the time, and knowing that New Zealand needed to get in front of it, that no one here was talking about it. And because of that early action that he led, and he mobilised and rallied others to support him, we wouldn't have had the successful response that we've had to HIV. So, we're really proud to have named the organisation after Bruce Burnett.